doesn't say such a talk name is forbidden, so.
I'll turn to some modularity, some thoughts on modularity and other things.
That's acceptable?
Simon's talk.
You have made.
Simon says.
But you haven't heard that one before.
No.
Can you have an ellipsis in a pad name?
But I prefer not to.
Can't take it on. If anyone else wants to take notes. Day 3, not day 1.
Oh, sorry.
And it's already there. You just have to click on it.
I have to go fast. Well, I think we're ready.
Okay. Okay. So that whole struggle with Etherpad was because I came up with a title. I gave a title for the talk, which was some thoughts on modularity in relation to scale and composition. Relation to production as process. How well I actually fulfill that title, I think, is to be seen. I'm not sure if I will. It was more kind of placeholder for some ideas, because I've just really put this together in the last couple of days. more concretely, I'm just kind of, I'm not going to talk about computing, I'm not going to talk about software. But some of what I'm going to talk about actually ties in quite well with what we were just doing. And it's kind of, in some ways, a kind of historical prequel to some of the things that we've been looking at, and a certain degree of historical development that maybe fits with what we've been looking at. It's also partly based around 3 books I happen to have been reading recently, related to other work I'm doing, which are Karen Barad's Meeting the Universe Halfway, which I think many of you will be familiar with. Donna Haraway's Crystals, Fabrics, and Fields, which I'm sure you know the name Donna Haraway, but this particular text may be less well known. This was her PhD dissertation, and it's a study on the development of organistic theory within embryology, and Haraway, which is studied within embryogenics, whatever it is. And then the third one is Amy Wendling's Karl Marx on Technology and Alienation, which is one of the sources for the stuff I've been doing on craft, which I'll explain a bit later. I was also kind of partly responding to there's a quote from Chantal Mouffe, which is given in the kind of outline for this workshop, which actually touched on things we haven't really talked about at all so far. So that quote was, universalism is not rejected but particularized. What is needed is a new kind of articulation between the universal and particular.
Okay. Notes in front of you so that when you look at them, you speak.
Good idea.
Thanks.
I'm meandering as I speak. So I'm not entirely comfortable with Muf's quote, and I don't think Femke is either, even though I think you chose it. It's a while since I've looked at Muf writing, but one aspect of her kind of project relates to this idea of agonism, the idea of kind of competition, and that in terms of this idea of decisions, the necessity of making decisions as political process. And the word decision means to cut away, to cut one thing away from another. Okay. So that ties into some of the things being cut off. This idea of cutting, which obviously is also important to pipelines, filters, grafts, such that it's a particular thing we kind of touched upon, but didn't really discuss in any detail. Although Jelko brought out the scissors towards the end. So this idea of the decision is kind of like why this and not that, and kind of Muf sort of presents the idea of political communities as decisions about why this and why not that, in this kind of simplistic summary of some of her aspects. So to some extent we can think of within that model politics as a form of production that makes different kinds of cuts into the civic and the social. And it's also echoed in the idea of criticality, and again, to critique, and criticality has similar origins, the idea of cutting things apart. And then you can also think of Deleuze and Guattari's idea of machines that cut into processes of flow. Although I'm not going to kind of talk in the Deleuze and Guattari model today. But in relation to the ideas of pipelines and modularity, we're maybe thinking more about how different production politics feed into one another, and what structures these might take, and how might we intervene in such structures. Which is not necessarily separate from cutting, but is a different sort of articulation around the political. So in part, I'm kind of going to look at three kind of phases where certain aspects of scientific thinking and aspects of political thinking kind of come together, and they relate to a certain degree to these ideas of scale and composition and modularity and connectivity, I say rather than pipeline. So first, Karl Marx and Wendling's study of Marx. What Wendling did in this study is she went into Marx's notebooks and looked specifically at his own studies of technology at the time that he was writing. And he took quite a great interest in the technological developments that were happening, steam engines and such, and also in developments in physics that were happening at the time that he was writing. And Wendling discusses how this influenced Marx's theories, in particular how they reflected in Capital. And one of the kind of key developments that was emerging at that time, which gets absorbed into Marx, was the idea of energeticist developments within physics. So the idea of energy started to become a kind of key area of thinking around this time. This consolidates in theories of thermodynamics, but the thermodynamics is not completely consolidated at this time. We're talking about the 1850s, roughly. So there's a kind of prior phase of discussion around this idea of energetics that kind of feeds into not only Marx's writing, but many other fields in the 19th century. And these ideas were emerging from many different areas. Philip Murawski, in his study Heat and Light, which is a similar kind of political analysis of energetics in relation to 19th century thought, sort of identifies two main areas where people were coming from. One was people working within engineering, working on steam engines and such, and other people coming from medicine and physicians. So you have figures like Joule, who was an engineer who worked in a brewery dealing with steam engines and such, and then you have someone like Hermann von Helmholtz, who was both a physicist and a physician, thinking about kind of physical processes. And these all start to coalesce around ideas of energy. Another strand that Murawski points to, however, which is often not acknowledged, is also a kind of, to some extent, these theories of energy are projection of already existing economic ideas onto the natural world. particularly the whole idea of double entry bookkeeping, and the whole idea of things balancing out, which Mirofsky argues is a kind of influence on the idea of conservation of energy, the principle of the idea of the conservation of energy within thermodynamics. And he points out, for example, that Jules was also the accountant of the brewery in which he worked. So he was familiar with double entry bookkeeping systems, as well as dealing with steam engines and sort of looking. So his kind of nexus of ideas that he was coming from brought together this particular model of economic practice with particular engineering practices and stuff like that.
What is double entry bookkeeping?
It's basically a form of accountancy in which you seek to balance, make sure that what goes in and what comes out balances out.
So you never put a single entry in. You always have an entry that has to come from somewhere and go to somewhere else. So it's always there's two ends of any entry.
Yeah, and this
invented by the Phoenicians, I think, in
the Medici.
Yeah, which 15 something, 14 something.
Banking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So exactly that phrase you use: what goes in must come out.
Yeah.
It's kind of projected and comes this idea of energy from the physical world. So Marx is following these ideas, and they start to appear in his writing. And in German, the term that's used within these discussions is Kraft, with a K, K-R-A-F-T. And Kraft in German has a lot of kind of nuances and associations that don't exist for the equivalents in English. So we would use like energy, force, power, and such in English, which have a kind of range of different meanings. But Kraft in German has certain connotations that relate into philosophy in particular. So in Kant you have Zeit, Raum, Kraft as a kind of key elements of part of kind of Kantian philosophy. You have in Herder the idea of Kraft as a kind of cognitive energy that language is expressed through. So language moves between people as a Kraft. And Herder also relates this to the idea of the Volk as a people who have a common energy, a kind of cultural linguistic energy. Kraft is also used in German discussions of Aristotle and the whole idea of the potential and the actual. Kraft is sometimes used to express the potential in some texts, and other uses it's used to discuss the idea of the actual. And some of these are kind of featuring in Marx. So one quite well-known passage which exemplifies that kind of the entrance of the idea of energy craft into Marx's thinking is this one here. Labour is first of all a process between man and nature, a process by which man, through his actions, mediates, regulates, and controls the metabolism between himself and nature. So he confronts the material of nature as a force of nature, which is Naturmacht in German. And he sets in motion the natural forces, Naturkraft, which belong to his own body, his arms, legs, head, and hands, in order to appropriate the materials of nature in a form adapted to his own needs. And through this movement, he acts upon external nature and changes it, and in this way, simultaneously changes his own nature. He develops the potentialities slumbering within nature and subjects the play of its forces, again, Kraft is used here, to his own sovereign power. So there's this idea of energy exchanging between humanity and nature, its production, but this also being a sort of transformative force process in its own right. Some of the physicists, the scientists that were looking into these ideas, had an interest in politics as well, and some were actively involved in the left-wing politics of the time. One whom Marx was in correspondence with was Ludwig Büchner, whose book Stoff and Kraft from 1855 was like a key text in the specifically materialist version of energeticist theory. And Büchner was involved in the 1848 revolutions and kind of actively supported the labor movements of his time. And he was someone who sought to use kind of theories of energetics to support labor struggles. I'll come a little bit onto that a bit later. But just to give a feel of how Büchner's ideas relate to Marx, a passage from Stoff and Kraft here describes the body kind of renewing itself and relates to this idea of the metabolic process, which is in Marx's text. So with each breath that passes from our lips, we exhale part of the food we eat and the water we drink. These change so quickly that we may well say that in a space of from 4 to 6 weeks, we are materially quite different and new beings, with the exception of the skeletal organs of the body, which are firmer and less liable to change. So kind of for Büchner's idea of Stoff and Kraft, matter and energy, or stuff and energy, to use the word more literally, he has this whole idea of the kind of constant renewal of the body as a metabolic process. And Marx is making an analogy with labor and a kind of metabolic processes, or sees labor as being part of the metabolic process of the human. So from this, Marx develops the idea of Arbeitskraft, which we normally translate as labor power. Again, the kind of Arbeitskraft has kind of stronger connotations to it that aren't there in the kind of English. And whilst the phrase is primarily connected with Marx, it actually first appears in Hermann von Helmholtz's work. So Helmholtz is using it when he talks about the whole idea of energy as work and how that operates across all kind of physical beings. So it's a kind of idea of a wider model of work rather than necessarily specifically human concept of labor or work. And Arbeitskraft is used in kind of two ways in Marx. It kind of works both to recognize and kind of give a name to what is happening with the way in which labor is being subject to capital. So Arbeitskraft becomes Marx's way of articulating the abstraction of labor by capital, in that Arbeitskraft is just the potential, the capacity to work without any connection to specific skills or abilities. And relates to the idea of labor as a measurable thing. But it also introduces ideas coming from people like Büchner of the idea of fatigue and exhaustion of energy within the worker. This idea of fatigue is used to kind of challenge the previous kind of moral arguments about work. So the earlier kind of bourgeois morality of work as ennobling and bettering. So for example, which is connected to the kind of the idea of sloth, of laziness as a sin, a sinful behavior in Christianity. So in Britain, for example, many of the early factories were run by Quakers and Christian spiritualists, and they saw the factory as a kind of ennobling device for the workers who were brought into them, and that work would improve the person and make them better. And an unwillingness to work was seen as sinful. So the whole idea that people would be subjected to working 18-hour days or whatever was not seen as problematic, but rather something that was ennobling for someone, because if they weren't working, they were going to be involved in viceful activities or something like that. So the concept of fatigue is kind of given scientific basis by people like Büchner, and it kind of feeds into the labor movement demand for the reduction of the working day. Marx has some criticisms of it. He sees that as a kind of reformist move, the way it happens, because he wants to see capital reach the point of exhaustion and collapse. Nevertheless, it enters into a kind of, manages to shift arguments away from a kind of moral concept of labor towards a material concept of labor. And that's important to Marx's wider project. Whereas the exploration of this idea kind of creates a tension within Marx's own writing between his earlier Hegelian approach to labor, which is based upon a kind of notion of the spiritual essence of the human, because it's the ability to work that separates the human from the animal, to consciously direct your work and fulfill yourself through the work you do. So there's, on one hand, a spiritualist argument within Marx, and there's also this materialist argument within Marx. And you can see both elements of that in the quotation I read earlier. So, and they kind of work in tension with each other, not necessarily always in opposition, but the tension is never fully resolved in Marx's writings. And Murawski points out that this tension between the kind of Hegelian spiritual model and this materialist model is also reflected in two different theories of value that exist within Marx. Again, are not quite ever resolved in his writings. So one is the what's known as the substance theory of value, the idea that value is a substance that permeates society and is transmitted through the commodity. And this is kind of coming from the Hegelian idea of value. And then there's the idea of, Murawski puts it as value as a field, as a kind of, that's usually called the real cost model of value, which is the idea of how value becomes dynamically composed of all the individual elements involved in the production and exchange of the commodity. So one, the kind of substance theory, has a sort of eternal ideal concept of value underlying it, and then this kind of field theory has a dynamic temporal concept of value. But Marx is not the only person looking at energetics in relation to ideas of economy. Also, the growth of, as Murawski argues, the growth of neoclassical political economics is also informed by ideas of energetics and thermodynamics. And in fact, whilst Marx adopts these in a slightly, in a critical fashion, he doesn't fully just adopt the ideas and integrate into work, he has a sort of critical reflection upon it. Murawski points out the kind of formation of neoclassical economic theory, which has within it this idea of equilibrium model, that the economy will equalize itself out through exchange, directly borrows from thermodynamic theory, in particular almost just grabs the mathematics and applies them to the economy as though they can unproblematically be translated from one place to another. And Murawski points out this creates a kind of contradiction, because on the one hand you have the idea of constant growth within capital, but if you equate growth with energy within the thermodynamic model, where you have conservation of energy, you can't have constant growth either. So there's a kind of contradiction within the
growth.
So Murawski points out the kind of neoclassical economics sort of plundering the mathematics is doing so more to kind of give itself a degree of respectability and to make it appear like a rigorous scientific theory that has naturalness as its basis, when in fact the consequences of borrowing thermodynamic theory into an economic model would be counter to the idea of a capitalist theory. So Arbeitskraft is basically what the worker sells. So as the free worker, as they're kind of described, enters into the marketplace, what they have to sell is their Arbeitskraft. And this is the potential to work, the potential to labor, a potential capacity that you have to labor. And then the capitalist buys that potential and puts it into actual use within the factory, within the production process. And profit arises in the difference between the value of potential labor, Arbeitskraft, and the outcome of actual labor. And so one of the key areas of capitalist structuring is to effectively to intervene within this translation between the potential and the actual, and to mask how one translates into the other. Uh, But as Wendling points out in her work, there's kind of wider implications to this idea of Arbeitskraft within Marx. They're not really fully developed in his own writing, and to some extent, because they relate to ideas that weren't really emergent at the time that he was writing, they come later. One is how the idea of the metabolic relates to the environment, and how this idea of a continuity of labour across the human and the non-human, the human or the animal and the machine, suggests a kind of different model from labour from that which capitalism itself is based upon. In relation to the idea of their environment, the metabolic principle recognises that all forms of production are necessarily taking away of environmental resources. And Mackenzie Warke has taken on this idea of molecular rarity, and he talks about what's called the metabolic rift created by capital. So the energy that is extracted at one point in production does not get returned or replenished at another point. So you create this metabolic rift. The example that Marx discusses is the use of nitrogen in farming and how intensification of farming uses up nitrogen in the soil, but then the commodification of the goods means that whereas, for example, in a pre-capitalist farming system, you'd have localized distribution of the goods, so that nitrogen which produces the food goes through the body and gets turned into excrement, which then goes back into the soil, so the nitrogen kind of is replenished at a local level. But as the production of food goes into wide-scale distribution, it gets displaced from the areas of its original extraction and therefore not renewed. So there's a kind of issue of nitrogen depletion. So Eleanor was talking about the farming systems that Scott talks about and how the state, how to see like a state. And they're in a sense an attempt to address that problem. But as Eleanor was saying, they're actually exacerbated. An example of that is kind of stuff that was happening in the UK, for example. In Scotland, you had the move towards the fishing industry and people being forced into working to the fishing industry through clearance and such. And the fishing industry is largely pulling out fish to create high protein food, which is then sent to plantations in the States and is used as food for slaves in order to put feed into the slave production system in the States. So the kind of food production in the UK then is feeding into commodity, other types of raw commodity production that are taking place in the colonies, which then are translated back into commodity production, such as cotton, which is then turned into cloth, which is woven in the factories in Manchester. So you get this kind of circulation of kind of energy through the production process, and it's kind of displaced through that. This is also kind of recognized, although addressed in a different way, by other economists such as Stanley Jevons, who's also a physicist and a mathematician economist, one of the neoclassical economists that Murawski talks about. But Jevons published a text called The Coal Problem, which was looking at the exhaustion of the coal supply in Britain during the industrial period. So the idea of peak coal, we probably call it now, was kind of being recognized. So the kind of Arbeitskraft framework is kind of a space for recognition of some of these problems, but of course they're not really addressed at the time. But an awareness of the kind of model through which different pipelines of the distribution of energy and natural resources is already there. The other aspect of it, which Wendling talks about a bit, is how this suggests a kind of post-human model of labour. So Kraft suggests the idea that labour is not just the unique contribution that humanity makes to the world, which is a kind of earlier kind of Hegelian concept of labour, but rather that production is something that happens across a spectrum of different types of producing agents and producing actor. And that might be animals, it might be machines, it might be people. And this is not kind of taken up in Marx, but Wendling sort of suggests this is in part a kind of way of remapping how production works in relation to nature. And she argues that kind of changes the shift from the idea of man working on the world towards the idea of production's nature working on itself. And whilst Marx doesn't follow this line, it does open up a different direction in Marx's thinking, that rather than the purpose of the labour movement or the critique of capital being to bring about better working conditions, to make work ennoble, to make work improving, as, for example, people like Ruskin or Walter Morris were doing in the Arts and Crafts movement, the aim should really be to reduce necessary working time and to think about how we can reduce the ways in which people are compelled to work and instead increase the possibility of free time to which people dispose of in their own way. Rather than, for example, in Ruskin, you get the whole idea of, he sticks to the idea that people should be compelled to work and that there should be a kind of guild that determines what work people should do within society, and that this should have an aesthetic benefits which make it ennobling, but it doesn't question the whole idea of the centrality of work. In Marx, there's the opening of this idea of questioning the centrality of work within society. As Wendling points out, Marx never fully accepts it. He tends towards it in passages like The Fragment of Machines and The Grundrisse, but ultimately sort of holds off on it. However, his nephew-in-law, Paul Lafargue, publishes a text on idleness and kind of suggests that we should just reject work completely. And so the kind of beginning of the kind of ideas of the rejection of work are kind of emergent in there. And there's also quite literally a kind of idea of pipelines emerging in the ideas of production. Wendling argues that in part this concept of Arbeitskraft came from Marx's analysis of how the machines of his day worked, the steam machines operated, and how they translated energy from the engine to the tool, which was through what was called the transfer belt. And the book has a kind of one of Marx's own drawings of this happening. So here we have the engine on this side, the steam engine creating the energy, which then is commuted to a belt operating this arm, which is then operating some kind of hammering tool on this end. And Marx kind of makes the analogy that the tool is where the actual skill of labor becomes, if you think, calcified, to use some of the words behind, and then the worker is turned into the equivalent of the belt that puts the tool into practice. So labor is part of this, something that is channeled along pipelines. There's a passage where Marx writes, "Whatever the social form of production, workers and means of production always remain its factors. But if they're in a state of mutual separation, they are only potentially factors of production. For any production to take place, they must be connected. The particular form and mode in which this connection is effected is what distinguishes the various economic epochs of the social structure." So within that, you have the sense of kind of an emerging idea of modularity of production, different modules, and also the idea of how these are connected in different ways is what determines the character of production at a given time. And that capital is one historically specific, the capitalist industrial model is one historically specific way of connecting these together. And it might be possible, therefore, to have other forms of connectivity within that. In a sense, part of what he's saying is a key area of kind of critical intervention is how the potential is translated into the actual as well, and how the potentialities of productive capacity that exist within society get translated into the actual forms of production that we have. And that how we intervene in this is kind of a key area of kind of political intervention. Right. So in the 20th century, one area with ideas of modularity become developed is in biology. And modularity is kind of one of the key theories that emerged out of the 20th century biological theory. And Haraway in her study is partly looking at how ideas of modularity within embryonic development informed the way of the concepts of organicist theory within biology. There are three key embryologists that she discusses, Ross Harrison, Joseph Needham, and Paul Weiss. And Needham is the kind of key person who articulates the idea of an organicist theory of biology. Needham, perhaps not coincidentally, is also one of the kind of key kind of consciously Marxist socialist scientists that were working in Britain in the 20th century. And there's a kind of period in British 20th century science where there's quite a strong commitment to kind of socialist and Marxist principles being put forward through science. J.D. Burnell's another famous figure in this, and Waddington, who's also a big influence on our ideas of ecosystems and systems theory within ecology. All were interested in the way in which science could articulate aspects of the kind of Marxist project, and science could be a means of changing the way in which production worked. So Needham's kind of one figure in this. Another aspect of the study is Haraway talks about how she's interested how sensuously lived metaphors shape scientists' understandings, and how the conscious use of metaphor within science shapes the way in which people study it. And that's what I think that has an interesting kind of parallel to kind of Eleanor was talking about LARP. And we can think of LARP as a sensuously lived metaphor of what different sort of social structures could be. Organicist theory overcomes the dichotomy of vitalist versus mechanistic theories of biology, which had dominated 19th century science. And energetics had been one of the kind of key areas of debate between these two different tendencies, of whether it was a vitalistic concept of energy or a mechanistic concept of energy. So vitalistic sort of perspective is the idea of a single transcendent principle of a non-material entity that gives life to substance. And the mechanistic is a kind of reductionist principle which seeks to determine what the fundamental unit from which all else can be built. So trying to identify what the core units are. I think the atoms, corpuscles is a word that's used a lot in kind of early mechanistic writing. Needham saw these rather than as being opposing ideologies, it's actually two sides of the same coin, in that both focused on identifying the inherent properties of entities and substances, whilst failing to recognise the importance of relations and temporal process. And Needham's idea of process looks to Alfred North Whitehead's concepts of process, processional philosophy, and draws some of Whitehead's work into his development of the idea of organicist theory. So he's saying there's neither a basic building block that we can identify as the essential unit from which all else comes, but neither is there some kind of external agency or spirit or whatever that gives life. Life emerges from within life, but there's no sort of one thing we can point to as the kind of origin of it. It's to do with relationships and process. One aspect of Needham's work was a rejection of the ideas of Ernst Haeckel. So Haeckel had been a German evolutionary theorist who had popularized Darwinianism in Germany, late 19th century, early 20th century, and whose ideas on evolution partly came out of the energeticist debates, and he thinks of evolution as being a kind of energeticist concept, the kind of, but it's very much based on a kind of substance theory of energy that emanates through life, and that this evolves to kind of higher life forms. Haeckel brought Darwinianism, evolutionary theory directly in relation to kind of Smith's concept of the division of labor. So Haskell argues that the emergence of distinct races is a form of division of labor happening at an evolutionary form, and that rather than rejecting division of labor, he argues division of labor is a way in which society acts upon its own evolutionary processes, and this kind of informs certain aspects of kind of proto-fascist economic theory that are happening at the time. So the whole idea of inferior races and classes is a form of evolutionary mechanism. Haskell, however, was somebody who began to identify a lot of the kind of earlier species and kind of organic forms that previously hadn't been studied. So another side to Haskell, however, is his starting to reveal, to blur the boundaries between the organic and inorganic. But he does it largely for a kind of vitalist, mechanistic, energistic model, which Needham kind of seeks to replace with the organicist model. One aspect of Haskell's theory that he's famous for is the whole idea of recapitulation, which is summed up in the phrase ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is the idea that an embryo, as it develops, repeats the history of the evolution of the species. So the different forms in which the embryo is in represent the kind of species evolution that happened over time outside it. Needham argues against this and says instead that stages of development in embryo do not always match or follow those of evolution. They sometimes take place in a different order. They sometimes skip steps that we know from evolution record maybe took place. And instead, he argues that as an embryo evolves from a simple cell structure into a complex organism, that it demonstrates different capacities which reflect those of the organism's physical complexity at that point in time. So even though you have a movement from simpler to more complex, it is not the same as the movements that happened in larger historical periods, evolutionary-wise. And you can make an analogy with the idea of child speech. So rather than thinking of an infant's speech as being a primitive form of human language, which was a concept that was quite popular in the 18th century, that how children spoke was how either primitive humanity spoke or how what Edenic language was, what the language of Adam and Eve was. Rather than it being this, a child's speech is a form of communication that's appropriate to the capacities of the child at that point in time. So it's not a lesser form of speech to adult speech, it's not a more primitive form of speech, it's a form of speech that's appropriate to the capacities of the child at the time. Needham also looks at the idea of malfunction within the organism, and particularly interested in the way in which malfunctions in one part of an organism do not necessarily lead to the entire organism failing. And this is one of the kind of problems that the mechanistic model had not been able to address, the whole idea that if one element failed, why did the organism as a whole not fail? Because machines, if that happens, the machine breaks down, a cog breaks, the whole machine goes down. But organisms seem to be able to restructure themselves. So Needham argues that structure is not static, but a condition maintained by the active metabolism of the creature. And we can relate this idea of the metabolism to the dimension of metabolism of the Arbeitskraft. And we can kind of broaden the metabolic concept of Arbeitskraft to think in terms of metabolism as a factor in capital's maintaining of conditions under which production takes place. And this relates to issues of things like domestic economy and the social reproduction of labor. So capital constructs particular pipelines through which metabolism can be controlled. And this relates the worker to the planet. So canals, sewers, irrigation systems. These are all kind of pipelines to control metabolism and to have control over metabolism. Uh, And modularity emerges as kind of key aspect of Organis's theory. And an explicit idea of modularity is not really present in either kind of vitalist or mechanistic models. And both seek to identify a particular single principle. Modularity looks more in terms of Organicist is looking for a sort of complex of elements. So Needham describes it in this way: every level of organization has its own regularities and principles, not reducible to those appropriate to lower levels of organizations, nor applicable to higher levels. He doesn't mean this in a strictly hierarchical sense, not necessarily as a power structure, but rather in terms of capacities appropriate to ability at a particular level of complexity. Paul Weiss develops this idea of modularity in relation to ideas of scale. The idea that things work differently at different scales, and one level cannot necessarily be reduced to that for lower level or another level. And then Haraway relates this to the idea of how boundary conditions left open by processes of one level are determined by the organizational plan of the next level. So modularity also contains within it the idea of the boundaries not being a discrete cutting between or a fixed structure between things, but rather modularity represents areas where control or organization pass between different modules, or the kind of boundaries between modules. And it's important they use the term conditions rather than the idea of the boundary substance. So scale and composition relate to one another and are integrated with the kind of biological concept of modules that, even if not directly communicating with one another, they nevertheless are related. And we see a shift from understanding from energetics and its development into thermodynamics. We see a shift from understanding in terms of substances with inherent identities to an understanding in terms of relations. And rather than thinking in terms of atom, cell, or corpuscle as a basic unit of analysis, Haraway argues that the relation is the smallest possible unit of analysis. So the organicist study of biology is, in a sense, looking at patterns of relation rather than looking at identifying inherent properties and identities. So this idea of relation and analysis takes us on to Barad, and her looking at quantum measurement and ideas of Niels Bohr, complementarity principle. One strand that runs through Barad's work is her bringing together Judith Butler's ideas of performativity with Niels Bohr's ideas of complementarity. So Barad points out that whilst Butler brings materiality into the constructive formations such as gender, she doesn't fully address the performativity of matter itself. And so Barad draws upon Niels Bohr's work to address some of this. Similarly, however, she argues that Bohr does not fully follow through the consequences of his own arguments about quantum measurement and falls back into an anthropocentric view that refers back to classical Newtonian physics. And Barad argues that this could be resolved by drawing upon Butler's ideas of the performative within measurement. Sorry, I just went too quiet. Yeah. So Barad identifies a kind of contradiction in Bohr's ideas, that on the one hand he recognises what is a very important distinction between quantum and classical physics, which is the idea of observation as part of the phenomenon that you measure, but that he ends up falling back into a kind of classical model in order to secure the idea of objectivity. So Barad argues that Butler's concept of performativity might articulate another way of sort of overcoming this kind of contradiction in Bohr. Central to this is the rejection of representational thinking. So the idea that there's stable representations that are adequately identical to discrete individual entities, such as the atom, the corpuscle, or the citizen, or the liberal subject. And here you sort of see a sort of connection with Muff, who is still working within a kind of representational paradigm. Similarly, it's a critique of the linguistic turn, the idea that what's known as linguistic monism, and the assumption that representations are inherently more accessible than the things they represent. And so Barrett wants to kind of keep the question over, rather than assuming that we can analyze representations any more accurately than we can analyze matter itself. Rather, there's a kind of we should not give superiority to the representational language. So in measuring quantum phenomena, Bohr argued that the apparatus used cannot be entirely outside of the thing measured, as the material conditions of the apparatus influence what can be measured. And Barrett gives the example of simultaneously trying to measure position versus momentum. So in order to measure the position of something that's moving, the apparatus must be fixed in space. So he talks about a camera on a tripod, or traditionally in particle physics, is a fixed plate where the particle hits. But in order to measure momentum, the apparatus must move with the entity. So the plate on a spring is able to measure the momentum because it moves with the thing hitting it. And you can't measure the absolute position at the same time as the thing is moving. So she argued that the concepts are defined by the circumstances required for the measurement. And this underlies the classic wave-particle dichotomy. The way in which we measure wave behavior is incompatible with the way in which we measure particle behavior. Because if we wish to measure wave behavior, we have to exclude the particle behavior, the particle behavior being, if you like, analogous to looking at positions. And similarly, if we wish to measure the particle behavior, this interferes with the wave pattern. So you can't get both from the one measurement. And Barrett discusses various types of thought experiments that Bohr and Einstein exchanged with one another as a way of kind of overcoming this this kind of paradox. So Barrett argues that quantum measurements, and equally all empirical measurements, therefore have a performative dimension in the kind of Butlerian sense, that we construct the conditions under which the measurement is recognized as such. And so she's arguing that this is analogous to how we construct the conditions under which gender is recognized. But Barrett goes on to say, this does not mean that matter does not exist or is a purely constructed, it's purely a construct. There is a matter that is there, which has been assigned a measurement, and there is a body is there in quotes, which has been assigned a gender, although gender is a much more complex and contestable variable than number. The performativity lies in how the matter and measurement, body and gender, are brought together into alignment with one another, or indeed how such alignments can be contested. Barrett writes, experimenting and theorizing are dynamic practices that play a constitutive role in the production of objects and subjects and matter and meaning. So Bohr argues that objectivity, at least in regard to quantum measurement, whilst recognizing the idea that you cannot entirely remove yourself from the situation of measurement, he sought to kind of reclaim some form of objectivity in the kind of conventional scientific sense. Bohr argues this can be retained in the situation of quantum measurement, because we can repeat the measurement and achieve the same result. But contrary to classical physics, number itself, the measurement, is not the representation that secures objectivity, but rather the fact that a given phenomena in which observer apparatus and observed subject can achieve a recurrent alignment is repeatable. So this is the idea of the phenomena rather than the measurement itself, which for Bohr becomes something that we can claim some form of objectivity from. And Barrett puts it down, for Bohr, the phenomena is the basic unit of physics. So not atoms, not numbers, but the phenomena for which observer, apparatus, and observed come together are what sort of constitute the kind of basic unit of physical theory. And then Bohr kind of argues that because of this repeatability, this reiterability, we can map the quantum phenomena back to classical frame of reference and the measurements of Newtonian physics. And this obviously clearly wouldn't map back to kind of Butlerian concept of gender. This would argue that a conventional normative concept of gender could be reconstructed through iteration. And this is where Barrett departs from Bohr and argues instead that an account of measurement should emerge from, rather than be imposed upon, the theory. And for Barrett, the possibility of objectivity, or maybe an alternative to that, arises through creating what she calls agential separability. And she uses the phrase exteriority within phenomena. And this is achieved by recognizing and accounting for how we make a cut between the observer and the observed within the phenomenon. So the apparatus is one way in which a cut is made between the observer and the observed. So in a sense, it's an issue of recognizing and accounting for how these apparati are built and how they perform within that situation as well, and not simply treating the apparatus as a neutral or exterior element to the kind of process. As Barrett writes, bodies differentially materialize as particular patterns of the world, which relates to her idea of diffraction, as a result of the specific cuts and reconfigurations that are enacted. And then she goes on in a way that challenges kind of Mouffe's position. She states, which cuts are enacted are not a matter of choice in the liberal humanist sense. Rather, the specificity of particular cuts is a matter of specific material practices through which the very notion of the human is differentially constituted. So the kind of cuts that Barrett is talking about, kind of decisionality, if you want, is kind of very different from what Mouffe is putting forward in her agonistic kind of model of the universe in particular. So to relate back more specifically to kind of political structures, we kind of had a history of different political structures, the feudal, the bourgeois property-based, the mass democratic, which relates to the information society, and what might is often described as a network culture today, or might think of as a highly differentiated political structures that we see today, representing things, issues such as identity, agenda, the problems of class composition and movement of movements and such. Each of these spawns its own critical practices. The Enlightenment was a response to the feudal political structures, Marxism's response to bourgeois structures, structuralism, post-structuralism, to a certain extent, a response to the mass democratic information political system. And again, there's also practices such as the food riot, the mass demonstration, the land grab, Occupy movement, activism, lobbying, etc., republicanism, nationalism, revolution, all different structures that respond to different political and economic structures. In his paper, The Reticular Fallacy, Alexander Galloway kind of notes a dissatisfaction with the what he calls the kind of reification of the network structure as a response to a highly differentiated society, and argues that we can't just take the network structure as a given emancipative or liberative form. And it's not so much a response, the highly differential political structure is not so much a response to problems of mass democratic informational society, but rather is a mode that various politics have taken in place and make use of in order to challenge it. So kind of neoliberalism is much a form of response to the development of a highly differentiated structure, as is network anarchism. So there's a kind of degree of mirroring between the two, they don't necessarily keep the same thing. So how do we develop a critical practice within that? So this kind of comes back to Muf's statement, in a sense that she is trying to address this whole idea of a highly differentiated political structure in her idea of reclaiming the universal in particular. But rather than putting forward the kind of integrative, integrational principle that Muf puts forward, which is based upon a representational model of entities who recognize each other within a particular structure, can we think about a kind of diffractive principle, diffraction being the kind of patterns of interference between waves that kind of quantum measurement looks at? And does the ideas or negotiations of modularity and connectivity relate to this? So modularity suggests something different from a particularity that partakes of the universal, in most parts, but is instead of thinking of politics drawing upon Needham's concept of modularity, that is appropriate to the different capacities at different scales, and how these connect, what boundary conditions are left open, and how do we negotiate or rearrange the way in which these are determined by larger structures. So relations are the units of the political rather than the subjects. In the same way that kind of quantum measurement recognizes that we are part of the nature that we seek to understand, we're also part of the politics that we seek to critique. And the idea of an entirely external position from which to critique existing political structures is not possible, as it may have been at one point when political structures were restricted to certain units of society, such as landowners. So if lived politics are not representations, but rather phenomena that we cut into through decisions and observations, how can we make explicit and hold accountable the conditions of their production, knowing that this will be defined by the circumstances required for the measurement or for the judgment, the circumstances required that enable us to produce a judgment within those conditions. Barrett argues that rather than drawing too strong an analogy between quantum physics and other areas, which I'm arguably guilty of doing within this talk, we should instead look to the kind of methodologies and what we can learn from the methodological developments. So the idea of the apparatus within quantum measurement has a methodological point, which is what Bohr is really trying to address. That the apparatus physically embodies a question which we ask of matter, and how we form the question, how we build the apparatus, influences what kinds of knowledge we can obtain, waves or particles, locations or momentums. Therefore, how do our questions constitute the kinds of politics we want to have? And then lastly, Barrett quotes Ian Hacking, and he reminds us that most experiments don't work most of the time. So rather than thinking of a supreme politics that will always work, how do we, echoing Judith Haberstein, think of how do we fail well at politics within this condition? So failing well at politics rather than addressing the universal in particular. That's where my thoughts led me.